Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast in sociology. I'm Patrick Sheehan, one of your hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dick Flax about his new book, written with his lifelong partner, Mickey Flax, titled Making History, Making Blintzes, How Two Red Diaper Babies Found Each Other and Discovered America. It's out from Rutgers University Press in 2018. Dick, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Usually we start these interviews by having the interviewee tell us a little bit about yourself, but since this book is all about your and Mickey's lives, I think we'll do it a little bit differently. Rather than have you recount your whole life here, and it's a compelling life, everyone should read the book, I'd rather introduce the book, give a brief tour of what it covers, and then dive into some questions on some of its main themes. So I'll do that now. So Making History, Making Blintzes, it's a shared memoir co-authored by Dick and Mickey Flax, that graciously opens a window onto the lives of two people who found themselves near the center of some of the most important moments and social movements of the American 20th century. The book trades off between Mickey and Dick's narratives and develops this theme of how they mix their private and public lives, how they combine political activism, making history, with the sort of day-to-day needs of life, making blintzes, traditional Jewish food being one of those, but also they made friends, they make homes, they make families, and how this is all woven together. The book begins with their mothers, actually, in the communities they grew up in the 1940s and 50s, radical Jewish communities in Brooklyn, and sort of shows how political activism was baked into their identities from the very start. They were the definition of red diaper babies, as the subtitle of the book suggests. The book then follows the two as Dick becomes a professor of sociology, Mickey a scientific researcher, and how they became involved in student organizing at the University of Michigan, finding themselves as founding members of Students for a Democratic Society and the New Left. We follow them through the tumult and excitement of organizing in the 1960s, civil rights, Vietnam, through high moments of high drama, such as Dick almost being killed for his activism. We move from Michigan to Chicago to Santa Barbara, California. And then we follow them past the 60s through the rest of their lives, how their activism transformed alongside the times and alongside their own biographies towards community-based politics in Santa Barbara, engaging in different ways with social institutions, electoral politics, Dick becoming what he calls a tenured radical. But the most compelling part of the book, I'll say, is how all of this political activism is woven in with their day-to-day biographies. Along the way, they have kids, they make a family, they keep up friendships, make new communities. And this is not separate from their political activism. It's all happening together. So the book has tons of lessons and inspirations for all kinds of people, from anyone interested in American politics in the 20th century, to academics who want to link their work to social justice, to activists and organizers, really anyone who wants to make a life that is meaningful. I'll let you, Dick, edit that summary throughout this interview, but I'd like to first start with a question sort of about identity politics. Like I mentioned, the beginning of the book starts with the community you grew up in and with your mother, who was a communist teacher in Brooklyn, and was involved in a lot of things through that. And it just seems like politics was baked into your bones from the very beginning. And I know that that's driven both yours and Mickey's activism throughout your lives. And identity politics comes up today as something that people talk a lot about, the pros and cons of it. I wonder if you would tell us sort of what you think about identity in your politics and then how identity politics can work or can't work.
That's a very big question. We could spend the rest of our time just on that one. But I think the word identity, the way is being used by you in two different probably meanings in one sentence there. Identity means who the individual is and aspires to be, and the individual's self-understanding of his or her past and as well as contemporary life. That's one meaning of identity, but the second meaning is collective identity. That is what group loyalties and group commitments one has and how these relate to one's self-identity. And identity politics, I think, came to be used to mean a politics that revolved around the defense of a particular group's cultural streams and values, a kind of defensive posture, or a struggle by an oppressed or disadvantaged group for recognition, for full equality, but based on that individual group's preservation, rather than counterposed to that, a more universalistic or class kind of politics, which says equality should be based on a universal sense of justice, that people of different histories and traditions should unite for common interest in justice and equality. And so identity politics got defined in this kind of discussion, as a kind of resistance to class politics or alternative to class politics. I have to say that I've always felt, based on our own experience that you alluded to, but also my reading of the American left and social movements, that this is all a little too simple. The American left, socialists, for example, in the 19th century and into the 20th century, and the organizations that they spawned and created, and even the unions they created, were deeply rooted in ethnic subcultures. Jewish socialism is a particular stream of American socialism. And so is Finnish, immigrants from Finland, and the socialism that they developed in the Midwest, in the Minnesota, and so forth. And I don't want to keep rambling on, but the point is, one of the distinctive things about this country, history, even on the left, is that class consciousness has always been interwoven with race and ethnicity. That's nothing new. The left struggle within, let's say, the Jewish world back in the early 20th century to get Jewish workers to see that they had common interests with workers of other backgrounds, even as they tried to cultivate their own particular Jewish cultural perspectives. So part of the story in our book is that Mickey experienced is that the Yiddish language, which was a vernacular language in Europe, became a literary language, a written language in this country because of the efforts of socialist organizers to speak to the Jewish working class. They were speaking a universal message, but in this particular framework of identity that the language and other cultural features provided. So this is part of what we wanted to convey in the book, is that these, and even the title, the Making History, Making Blintzes, sort of implies that even the collective identity that is used to define identity politics can be a significant force for social change on a universal level, even as you try to adhere to and enrich your own particular group identity. And that's actually the experience that Mickey in particular, she was raised in a Yiddish-speaking family. She didn't speak English till she went to school. In the Bronx, she actually was in the Bronx, not Brooklyn. What she learned in that way was this set of universal values about human emancipation, but in the Yiddish language. I don't know if that makes sense. Maybe you got other things you want to probe around that, but that's sort of a entree into how I think about these things. We're very critical of those who say identity politics or identity perspectives should be given up in favor of some universalistic framework. That's never been, and it's not true that it's part of the American past was universalistic, and only in the 60s did identity politics begin to emerge. That isn't a true story at all.
Right. I want to follow one part of that, of just something I really took away from the book, is I feel like we often think about political activism as being driven by a deep value system, deep ideologies, and clearly Mickey and yourself grew up in those. But it's also, as the book demonstrates, your activism and your organizing and your values are very embedded in the communities in which you lived, both growing up and then in Michigan and everywhere else. I wonder if you could speak to, I don't know, is this like values-driven activism? Is it community-driven activism? Or how do those two relate?
Well, it relates through, I think, the word democracy. In trying, both of us and a lot of other red diaper babies of our generation, people who were raised within, say, the communist world or the old left, who grew up with socialist or communist parents, by the late 50s, people like that who were in school or getting out of college and still young wanted a left, but they didn't want the left of the past. And the left of the past, the old left, was defined, as you're suggesting, ideologically. The socialists at war with the communists around very coherent doctrines that they believed they were enacting. I think when we came together at Port Huron, Michigan, 40, 50, 60 young people to create a new left organization, we all came from those different backgrounds, but wanted something that would fuse our perspectives and start something fresh. And the framework we adopted, or the key to it, was the term used in the Port Huron Statement, participatory democracy, radical democracy, complete democracy. That's what socialism really was about, in my opinion. And I've written quite a bit about this. And I think it's at the heart of the Port Huron Statement. We don't even use the word socialism in that statement as a part of defining our shared perspective, we the SDS. Instead, it was participatory democracy. Well, that once you say my goal as a political activist is to promote democracy, then that to me, resolves the kind of issue you were alluding to in your question. It isn't that you're trying to impose on people a set of ideas or get them simply to agree with you on certain issues or to endorse your brand. The goal is to get people to act for themselves, to define for themselves what their interests are, to seek their own empowerment, whether it comes to, in every aspect of life, including micro level as well as macro level kinds of decision making and rule making. And resource allocation, all of those things should be as much as possible under the control of the people who are affected by those kinds of decisions. That's how we put it in Port Huron Statement. So I that's how I would answer the question that you're raising. It's not about preaching to people to convert them to something. It's more like enabling and facilitating and encouraging people to act for themselves collectively. And in that case, in that framing, in a way, we're very we're coming up against certain features of American culture that are difficult, and that's the whole individualism and concepts of individual self-reliance as the way to make your life. That's always what the left wants to challenge. The left wants to say to people, the problems you know you have need to be articulated together with those who share those problems and acted upon collectively. And often American history shows that many, many, many parts of our history are shaped by that kind of collective action. It's not that we're bringing something to people who don't have that potential until we are there.
If I could jump in there, Dick, there's something about your answer there. And when I read about the new left, I read your writing, it feels to me that there's just such a clarity of purpose sort of that you all had then and have carried with you that as someone, I'm a millennial and I've grown up in this sort of 2008 political moment. And it just feels as someone who's politically engaged, it just feels sometimes so confusing and chaotic what exactly the problems are, what exactly the solutions are. And whenever I'm looking back at the 60s, as a lot of people that are politically conscious of my age do, it looks like everything was sort of obvious. Or, you know, it sort of seems like the problems were so immediate and in your face, civil rights, Vietnam, and the solutions sort of what you were supposed to do looks to me to have been obvious. But I don't know if it felt that way. I guess I want to get your take on, you know, just the concept of participatory democracy. How do you come to that? Or how clear-minded were you all at the time? Does it look more clear looking back?
Well, I mean, in terms of what people mobilized to act around, yes, we were that 60s generation who became activists. We were lucky in the sense that you're putting it, in that certain very glaring features of the current world were so necessary to overcome and oppose on moral grounds, if nothing else. So civil rights is maybe the clearest example. There's no way to avoid the fact that a society claiming to be based on principles of democracy and equality and liberty, that a society like that practiced apartheid segregation, extreme suppression of people based on their race, had been based on slavery. And the remedy for that lay in the actual claims of the Constitution of the United States. That's a straightforward set of issues to confront, and a sense of the potential for change being there because of the Constitution and the society's claims. And we white privileged kids, very challenged by the incredibly inspiring actions of black students in the South to do things like sitting in and freedom rides and putting their own bodies on the line, challenged us, what are we going to do to respond and to support those clear moral challenges. Vietnam wasn't so simple in that all of the public presentation of that war in the media and in politics were justification of the war. But where it became simple for students was that on some of the major campuses, like Michigan, where I was, and then Chicago, University of Chicago, where I was, and other major universities, there were faculty already studying the Asia, studying the history and the developmental situation in that part of the world, who were deeply and profoundly upset with with the war policy and began to speak about it. The institution of the teach-in, where faculty met with students for all-night sessions, educating about the details of those conditions and of a policy, led to then decisions to take action, which became very multifaceted and complicated, and in terms of what choices you made and what could actually work to change the war policy or to stop the policy. It was a tremendously intense movement that went on for really 10 years, from 65 to 75. And so those who got caught up in the opposition to the war, you're right, it was simple. That was our preoccupation. Every day we had pictures on images on television of burning children and burning villages and the U.S. bombing the hell out of a small country that had no way of retaliating militarily. And then our understanding that it was a war of white, a white superpower against a community of people of color, of peasant-based society, a colonialized society. All of those made it very clear morally, and also, but not so clear strategically. How do we overcome this? In the sense of knowing what to fight about, fight for, and fight against, you're right. Those were two, civil rights in Vietnam were the two big examples. I have to say that the nuclear arms race was the third. It didn't quite have the same ongoing drama of protest and resistance. The ban the bomb movement, which was very prominent at the beginning of the 60s, had its was superseded by the overall anti-war, anti-Vietnam movement in terms of people's preoccupation. But the idea that the human race could be wiped out by the decisions of a couple of leaders of a couple of countries was so obviously something that had to be challenged. I'm just confirming what you're saying. There were very specific, if extremely difficult, moral challenges that those of us who were looking for a way to reengage in social change we were moved by. That's why we wanted social change. Were these challenges were there. But the conversation in SDS and on campuses among progressive activists from the beginning was these problems are expressions of a deeper system contradictions or systemic, fundamental systemic problems that needed to be transformation, not just resistance was necessary. And that partly was because people had read Marx or were familiar with the radical critiques of capitalism and of imperialism, bringing those ideas into the movement, but also because if you think like the war in Vietnam, here's a war that's deeply unpopular in the country, that the United States was losing. And yet you had Lyndon Johnson, president, Nixon, president, saying openly, I'm not ending this war, even if the majority of people oppose it. That sounds like a system problem, not just a policy difference, if you want to say it. And so the larger question or the deeper question of social transformation, that was not something the New Left thought we had answers for. Participatory democracy, to me, as a way of framing the vision, at least gives you guidelines for how to act and how to think about alternatives, which is the fundamental idea being the alternatives need to increase ordinary people's capacity to have a voice in the decisions affecting them. So that's the standard against which you measure your ideas for alternative social organization. And in terms of action, if you seriously say, well, our actions should be guided by an effort to increase democracy, not only in a future society, but in the immediate situation, that kind of helpful in choosing what kinds of action choices you will make, I think, but it doesn't simplify anything.
And if I could just jump on that, what do you think about the enduring legacy of that vision? I mean, what have you learned since the Huron statement that that leads you to edit or move those ideas forward?
Well, I...
Did you miss something then? Did you need something extra?
I felt until recently that the logic of social change going on in the world really was in the direction of participatory democracy. And I think the high point of that was perhaps the overthrow of the communist parties in Eastern Europe through mass uprisings, different colors of revolution in the streets of Prague and so forth. And then even the Arab Spring was another case in point. It isn't that participatory democracy simply means mass occupations of the public squares and the bringing down of the authoritarian regime. But my romantic self said to myself, those uprisings must be the beginning. They certainly going to be the beginning of a fervor in those societies for a more democratic way of operating. So to me, and I don't have deep knowledge enough to understand this, the result of those efforts was to restore authoritarianism, not with the label communist authoritarianism, but not that different. And that's a big disappointment to me, but to the whole idea that there was a arc of history that was bending toward democracy, which is what I was quite sure of. I still haven't given up that hope and that belief, but I think that everyone who's serious politically has to take account of the enormous return of authoritarian, it's not just authoritarian regimes, but regimes that are like thugs, that are rackets as well as dictatorial in so many countries. I don't have a theory for explaining this or even an idea of knowing. I do take a lot of hope from the fact that in some of those countries, there is now a democratic backlash going on. People are organizing in an opposite and resistant direction. So in Poland, in the city of Warsaw, huge demonstrations recently against the authoritarian policies, just as one case in point. There are other examples that are not so good. I mean, I don't understand Russia and the seeming passivity of the Russian people toward the Putin gangster regime. I understand intuitively why Chinese people don't necessarily yearn for democracy above all other things. And in a way, maybe, but I don't want to go off on those kind of tangents. So on the other side, on the more progressive, hopeful side, even though we are currently experiencing this authoritarian thug as our own president, I see at the base of a society, and this is partly what our book is about, in the last 50 years being here in California, a very widespread pattern of social movement and collective action toward democratic control on a community level. Environmentalism is basically a movement for where communities can get control of their future in terms of certainly environmental kinds of issues, but really even beyond that, the environmental movement is saying we need community control of life, of the conditions of our life. And that, I think, is, with ups and downs, something that's been a process in a state like California. The growth of the movements for equality and so-called identity movements, but based on oppressed communities who are not only demanding, but achieving levels of participation and recognition and representation that that fulfill what we were hoping 50 years ago might happen. California is now a majority-minority state. Government is filled with people who come out of Latino and other minority movements. Gay rights is another example of it's not just a movement for gay rights. It's a movement for, again, the right of people to control their own lives rather than to be dictated by rules over which they have no control.
I want to pull back to one of the themes of the book, and I'm going to speed up a little bit. The heart of the book is in the 60s, I would say. There's about four chapters titled Our 60s that are brilliant and readers should turn their attention to. But I want to ask you about one of the themes, and that's related to some of your own research, which is how activists and organizers, how they sort of keep up and reinterpret and try to live out their activism even outside of the 60s moment. I mean, the book follows you two, Mickey and yourself, as you maintain this sort of political life into the 70s, into the Reagan years and all that. And I've read the other book of yours that I know well, which is Beyond the Barricades, is a very interesting take on looking some years later, two decades maybe, at a group of activists in Santa Barbara in the 60s, sort of how are they living out or not living out their political ambitions of their younger years. Could you tell me a little bit, maybe just about your thesis in that book, how it played out in your lives and how people sort of continue to live out their political selves, even in different, totally different situations and different political moments?
Well, that's really one of the key questions that we were trying to deal with, not only in the book, but in our own way we live. Mickey and I feel that we, in the 60s, were at odds with a lot of what was prevailing among the young people that we were working with about these kind of issues. The general view in the 60s among left-wing young activists was that the most honorable way to live was to be totally committed from morning till night to the, you might say, to revolution, and that meant no entangling relationships that might preoccupy you in opposition to your commitment to the movement. And that kind of total organizer way of living, which is quite appealing, I think, to a lot of people, young people in their, as they get out of college and look for how to make a meaningful life. Well, total commitment, meaning I don't want to start a family. I don't want to get married. I don't want to have a regular job. I want to be in the movement 24/7 because the urgency of now, the urgency of conditions requires that kind of self-sacrificing commitment. But it isn't simply sacrificing. It's a kind of heroism in a way, I guess. We were already married when we went to Port Huron. We were a couple of years older than most of the people there. We already had jobs. And Mickey in particular, from her working class roots, would always say to me, look, I don't want to live that kind of rootless life. And Mickey herself, more than even I, wanted a life in which, as she put it, I need to know, you know, how we're going to get food on the table. She defined it as a kind of working class attitude.
Another question I'd like to ask Dick, as a young scholar myself, is you have a lot of reflections in the book on being a tenured radical, on trying to fuse your scholarship as a sociologist with your political activism. And I'm finding, as I enter this world, a lot of sort of contradictions between the requirements of the academy and the requirements of political organizing. I'm wondering if you could tell us about how you've made sense of those two things throughout your life, how you've brought them together, when you found it difficult to bring together, and how you found your way forward.
Well, the book tells stories about the sort of struggles I had within academia against various kinds of conservative and traditional and hierarchical practices that at the University of Chicago, you know, I was a young member of a very conservative top-down department that had gone through some battles even before I got there, in which quantoid sociologists, scientistic sociologists, drove out more humanistic figures in the early 60s. I got there, maybe they thought I was one of them, but really for a couple of years didn't even say much at department meetings and so forth. But I did have, again, I had the good fortune of being a political sociologist and a social psychologist who could teach and research on the very same issues that I was engaged with as a person, as a political actor. It was all, to me, one coherent piece. That's a great piece of good fortune, of course, I helped shape those opportunities for myself. But I could do a research project on the social origins of political activists, a project that had bore very good fruit in terms of results and became a very well-known piece of research about helping to understand what was going on in the 60s. I had the good opportunity to do that while I was at Chicago. I had some allies in the senior faculty of the university for that. I spent a great deal of time, but the fact that you are able to control your own time to some extent as a professor was beneficial. I could go and be part of various kinds of organizing situations in the city as part of my work as a sociologist, and I had the flexibility to be able to do that. When things came to a head in terms of confrontation and irreconcilable conflict was when my department at Chicago refused to renew the contract of a young assistant professor named Marlene Dixon. She's one of the very few women in the entire faculty of the University of Chicago. She was a junior faculty member. She had was up for renewal of her contract, not even a tenure decision. And the department senior faculty voted to terminate her. She was a popular teacher, which they didn't know because they paid no attention to her teaching. And she was a lefty. And so the student movement activist subculture on campus rose up to protest her firing, occupied the administration building for more than 2 weeks. It became a big issue in the city, a big, very visible event. And I was one of the few faculty in the entire campus to support the student demand, which was really that students should have some voice in the decisions about the faculty, especially when in terms of people who served their needs as teachers. And so I was in really severe conflict with the senior faculty, and we tell a good number of stories about this, I think, in the book, which I won't delve into. But because I had done work that got visibility, I got a job offer in California from UC Santa Barbara, which I eventually accepted, and that was a tenure position. Once I got here in 69, because I was publicized as a founder of SDS, being hired with tenure at the University of California, by that time SDS was considered a subversive revolutionary organization. There was a move by Governor Reagan to try to get rid of me right at the start, but that failed for a number of good reasons. So I had moments of being embattled, and then after I got to the faculty here, our department, because it had hired me, and for other reasons, the activism of some of the faculty and a lot of the students in sociology here at UCSB, meant that the department was pretty embattled in those first years of the 70s. There's a big split in the faculty between old guard faculty who very much frightened by the fear that Reagan as governor and the right wing would come down and destroy the university. Therefore, they said, we have to do the repression so they won't come in and repress the left, that repress the whole campus. That was their kind of reasoning. And then there was this younger generation of faculty who had recently arrived at UC Santa Barbara, and I was one of those people who challenged that way of thinking and who wanted to be, you know, we wanted a more democratic university. We wanted a curriculum that could embrace the social issues of our time. We supported Black studies and Chicano studies and other interdisciplinary ventures into that were being resisted by old guard academics. So I guess the point I'm making is that it wasn't that I found a way to fuse activism and my academic role and easily fulfilled that. It was always something that even in more benign circumstances, you still have to struggle with, because how you use your time, how that relates to the rewards and promotions of academia, that becomes an issue. What kind of research you do, how it's evaluated, all of those are issues that have to be struggled with. So one of the important things in the late 60s that happened in higher education was the formation of what initially was called radical caucuses in the disciplines. We helped found something like that in sociology back in 68, 69. And these caucuses, which began to publish journals and became formations within, say, social science disciplines, you know, they were looking critically at the nature of the discipline, the theoretical foundations, the kinds of issues that were being addressed, as well as the practices within the university and defending. There were quite a few faculty who lost their jobs because of their activism. I could go on and on with this, but the point is organization became important nationally, especially in my generation, organization along disciplinary lines. And that enabled people to feel support networks around the country and make use of those. It enabled intellectual work that was innovative and challenged the status quo in those disciplines. What happened in sociology, maybe more than a lot of other social science disciplines, was that people were elected to as president of the American Sociological Association, figures like Michael Burway or Eric Wright in recent period, and others who advocated as president of the disciplinary association, what Borowé called public sociology, a sociology that served social needs, a sociology that could connect with social movements, not just with the elite. There may be departments where such perspectives are not honored, but the fact that the ASA recognized, sort of official level, the validity of this kind of perspective was an important, to me, change compared to when I was in graduate school and when I was at the University of Chicago, where such views were called underground sociology. Now they're part of the dynamic of the discipline itself. I sound optimistic there, but I'm not, because I think that when push comes to shove and people are trying to publish in journals and get jobs and get tenure and all that, they fall back on a kind of work that C. Wright Mills called abstracted empiricism, meaning turning out of studies for the sake of their publication rather than because you're actually trying to solve real issues and real problems through your research. And my own view is, and my advice to students is always, graduate students, is respond to your heart and your gut and your curiosity and your values, even if it seems like it'll get, that doesn't give you the easy path to professional recognition, because peer-reviewed journals can be, they will reject articles because they don't meet the rigorous standards that narrowly focused research is more easily able to reach. Just one example. And the kinds of petty politics that you find in academic departments can be extremely deflating in terms of people's more higher aspirations for doing the kind of work they want to do, because that kind of politics I always wanted to challenge and explode rather than allow to fester. But because it's very easy to fall into armed camps and warfare struggles in academic departments, partly because people, I think, their lives are not that exciting. So the drama of department warfare may take the place of dramatic life or something for some people. So that's not a very good solution. There's no way to, if you get onto the stage of being in the job market, you need to really see that the places you want to apply to are ready to recognize and appreciate your work. You do have to do the work. In other words, there's no substitute for actually doing the scholarly work, doing the research, during the intellectual work that is, by published, I mean made available to wider publics for debate and discussion and use. But I think you're concerned, like I was, with how is teaching fit into that mix? And I think in something you wrote me, in the email you wrote me, you were saying you think teaching is even less recognized in the career evaluations that you get than it used to be. Well, that's a complaint that's been there for 75 years in academia, that same language. So I'm not sure that anything is worse now than it's ever been. I do think there are, one of my sons is a sociologist teaching at a community college, and he did that move because he wanted to teach. And at a community college, that is what is valued but if you get your graduate degree at a research university, it's that kind of career move is considered second rate and not what you should be doing. I don't, you know, that needs to be examined, that way of thinking. Where are people actually freer to be who they want to be if they want a academic role that is value oriented and that is making a difference? Maybe junior colleges should not be considered marginal, especially at a time when the society is likely to be investing more and more at that level of higher education, especially when there are a lot of students in community colleges who may be the very kinds of young people you want to be connected with. It's easy for me to say because I'm retired, I'm not. but based on my son's own experience, it's not a bad path. But I'm not recommending it as the main path. I'm just saying that some of the assumptions that we get in graduate school about what the right kind of career is, those assumptions themselves may not hold water. I know here, even at the University of California, at UCSB, which is very much a research university, there are teaching positions now being set up that are full-fledged faculty positions that emphasize teaching. I'm surprised that this has happened, but it seems to be happening. Not on a big scale, but those jobs are currently being advertised here at UCSB in a couple of fields. If that's a sign of something happening, maybe it is, because that criticism of the ignoring of people's teaching roles in their career path, in their career evaluations, that criticism, you know, is very widespread. It's there in the legislature. It's there in the public world as well as within the university. And I would say it's always been a valid, extremely valid point, even though I'm willing to buy the argument that if you're doing exciting research, you're going to transmit that excitement to your students in the classroom. I'm certain that that can be the case. But if people who are really devoted to teaching fail to get tenure, that's a counter, very much counter to the commitment to teaching. And teaching is too simple a word. I think teaching can include your public role, your role as a community educator in a field like sociology. Do you spend time in public sociology? And how is that evaluated when you come up for promotions and tenure and all the rest of it? I think we have to fight for those principles, that is the widening of the career paths. We have to fight for that. And as a faculty member with some role in governance, you have those opportunities to fight for that. And I'm critical of a lot of younger faculty these days who don't get involved in governance and who figure out their own little niche where they can be comfortable and bargain for their own particular benefits and privileges, and don't spend the time in the day-to-day of critically evaluating the way the institution operates, because the obviously, main trend in society, including university, of course, is so-called corporatization, the selling out of the university to the highest bidder. That can be resisted by the faculty, as it's being similar kinds of battles are going on within Google and other of the IT firms, where staffs are saying, we don't want Google to be doing this kind of partnership with, you know, weapons makers or something like that. That's the transfer of battles that were happening in the past on campuses into the business corporate world, which is a very hopeful thing, that there is that kind of worker organization for principals within corporate operation. Well, that's another argument for academic governance as a framework of political action, because what happens on campus can be a model for what happens in other institutional settings, I think. That's a long and rambling answer, but maybe
a helpful one for sure. I want to ask another question that brings us a little bit back to the book. After going through Mickey and your Santa Barbara years, you sort of bring us to the current political moment. There's some reflections on Trump as well as the Bernie Sanders campaign and the political revolution behind that. And you note in there that there are some striking similarities between Bernie's personal biography and political history and your own. I wonder if you could tell us about some of those parallels, and then what does that mean to you, the fact that he and his ideas have sort of set the tone for Democratic Party politics in 2020, and he himself is steps away from the Oval Office. What does that mean to you? Please, give me your reflections on that.
Yeah, so Bernie's a couple years younger than me, and was born in Brooklyn, not too far from where I grew up. He went for a period of time to my alma mater, Brooklyn College, after I did. I wasn't there when he was there. And then he transferred to the University of Chicago just before I got to teach there. So the two of the colleges that I was involved with were also places that he was at. When he was in college at Chicago, he didn't join SDS. I'm not sure there is even an SDS chapter when he was there. But he joined something called the Young People's Socialist League. And I think he was probably raised to some extent in Brooklyn back in the when he was in his childhood, that his parents or his neighborhood had a lot of lefties and socialists and so forth. So his attraction to the Young People's Socialist League, which was a long, old organization, was founded in the 1930s, YPSL it was called. So he was a member of that, but his activism really revolved around civil rights. He was involved in sit-ins at the University of Chicago protesting the fact, and this is hard to believe, that even in the 60s, the university owned housing had restrictions on blacks being able to rent the housing. And he was part of a protest that overthrew that secret covenants, as they were called, in the Chicago neighborhood at that time. So anyway, he moved to Vermont. That was something that was happening quite a bit in the late 60s and early 70s, moving out of the big city and into sort of virgin territory, if you will, where the political field might be open. And I guess he wanted from the beginning to see what could happen if he ran for office with that socialist politics. And he ran on a kind of third party ticket and didn't get anywhere that way at first. And I'm not sure of all the steps he took. It's not that relevant, but he stayed within the electoral world to a great extent and finally succeeded by being elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont, which is not a big city, but it is the capital of Vermont, and be very successful as mayor in promoting job creating development and promoting good municipal practices, made a good name for himself, ran. Vermont only has one member of Congress, so he got that seat. And now he ran as an independent. And that shows a tremendous political success because he ran against the two other parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and he won those seats, and then senator. And that speaks to political skill, which I think should not be underrated, the fact that that he was able to demonstrate that his, not only he as a person, but the political policy framework that he was bringing would be preferable to the two old parties. Now, I think he ran for president in 2016 with no expectation of getting anywhere, but of wanting to inject certain ideas into the political dialogue, so to speak, like universal health care and the $15 minimum wage. And I think he was probably surprised by the degree to which he got support vis-a-vis Hillary in the primaries, to the point where he was became a very serious contender. So there's a couple of things about that effort of his that really were surprising and intriguing to someone like me from the New Left. I've said before, we at Port Huron did not call ourselves socialists because we thought the word socialism carried so much negative baggage in America, and even for us. I mean, socialism meant to Americans either Stalin-style communist dictatorship, or to a lot of us young people in the early 60s, social democracy in Europe, which didn't really challenge the basic logic of capitalism, as far as we believed. And it seemed like a new vocabulary, including terms like participatory democracy, should replace socialism in the American lexicon of the left. And that's what we did. So to have a guy not only say that he's a socialist, but then get a tremendous amount of support running for president, but not only running for president, after the campaign, he's the most popular, I think, politician in the country in terms of his approval levels. National politicians, he probably has the highest approval level, or one of the highest, maybe the highest of anybody on the national stage. He's got a lot of disapprovals too. And so thinking a lot about this, and it's, first of all, why does he call himself a socialist? That's one of the ironies of this, because his whole program running for president is European social democracy. It is not what we used to think of socialism meant, that is public ownership and control of the means of production rather than private corporate and business operations, getting rid of the profit system. He doesn't talk about that. He doesn't even talk about worker-owned businesses, which there's quite a few in Vermont, and I have very close friend who is the CEO of a very successful worker-owned business in Vermont, who says that in Vermont, Bernie was always very supportive of that, but that's not been part of his national agenda, as far as I know. In fact, footnote, Elizabeth Warren has advocated that workers have the right to elect members of the boards of directors, 40% of the boards of directors of the major corporations. That isn't anything Bernie has advocated. And yet it's part of his history to understand that kind of worker management idea as an important possibility. So how do we figure this out? He's calling himself a socialist, even though the main pillars of socialist ideology are not part of his program. How do we figure that out? Well, first, brilliantly, I think he is not rejecting, he could say, yeah, I was a socialist when I was young, but I'm no longer that. That would end Bernie Sanders, in my opinion, relevance. Then he would be just an ordinary politician. He is saying, I've always been a critic of the system, and I still proudly wear this democratic socialist brand. And that gives him a sense of integrity, conveying that he's a man of integrity, a person of principle, a person who will not simply bend to corporate dictation or corporate inducement, given those principles. So that's, I think part of his popularity rests on the very, not because people necessarily know what socialism means at this point or in any point. I mean, again, footnote, when I was teaching, I didn't think most students could had a way of defining socialism because the term has been used so variously and so differently over the years of history. So anyway, that's one part of it. But why? But then his program, what's brilliant about that, things he ran on in 2016 and he's continuing to run on, every single thing he has advocated is supported in public opinion surveys by the majority of Americans, every single item. And yet none of them are on the agenda of mainstream politics, whether we talk about Medicare for all, universal health care, when we talk about free tuition in public universities, whether we talk about the green infrastructure ideas. When he started to run in 2016, $15 minimum wage was just on a kind of state level coming to the political discourse. So, but when people are asked about these ideas, strong majorities in most cases, have endorsed them. And I'm struck by that just personally, because I used to teach political sociology with that as a starting point. I give students these poll data on support for things like that and say, here's this stuff that the majority of Americans want from their government. And they're not only not getting it, they're not even hearing their people running for office advocate these things. So I feel kind of great that I had this insight as a teacher that he then has capitalized on as a candidate, as a way of educating people about what needs to be done to change America. And that is quite brilliant. I'm making all this up. I've never heard him say any of the things that I'm saying now about why he's done these things. He's very on message all the time, the message always being to advocate these ideas and to criticize the billionaire class controlling our politics. And he doesn't explain that much. Maybe he has in things that I haven't read about that he's written, why he has framed his whole effort as both socialist, even when it's not socialist, but around these, they're Europeanized. That's another advantage of these principles, of these policies he's advocating. They are in practice in other countries. They're not just pie-in-the-sky ideas. And yet, in most cases, they're ideas that at one time or other have been part of the American political discourse, but not recently. And so it's not that these are foreign ideas. There are ideas that in other countries have been adopted. So the question then becomes, why can't we do these? And the question's been now being asked by a great many Americans as a result of Sanders' efforts. So I support Sanders and give money to him because I want that voice to be out there saying these things and doing these things. Do I want him to get the nomination? No. Maybe naively and foolishly happy that we've got this range of candidates. I think because of his influence, everyone running so far has some ideas that are breakthrough ideas. You know, when Bill and Hillary, they practiced the politics of very incremental, marginal change as what they advocated. That was deliberate. Bill Clinton advocated that if you want to run for office as a Democrat, don't promise anything big. Talk about school uniforms. Now all the people running for office have some very significant structural change or major reform ideas that they've put on the agenda. I'm happy to see them compete to see who's got the most capacity to win a popular base. as a 81-year-old guy, and Bernie would be 81 if he were elected pretty soon after being elected, I wonder whether, not because I don't feel incapable of being an effective person in the world, but I'm ready to move to a retirement village. I don't think the White House is a retirement village atmosphere. So I'm not sure why whether he even really wants to win and be president. I guess he's enough of an egomaniac that he probably does want that. But at this point in the process, it's good that he's out there. And look what's happened. So Elizabeth Warren, who said, it's almost like someone's written about this, that back in the turn of the 20th century, you had debate within the mainstream of progressive politics between sort of anti-capitalist perspectives and strength and reforming capitalist perspectives. So Elizabeth Warren's claiming she wants to strengthen capitalism by making it work for people. The net result of that is not very different in terms of the actual policies that might be advocated. And in her case, she's coming up with ideas that are better than Bernie's because they actually are structural changes, like worker participation and management as one case, or a wealth tax, which really has been waiting a long time for that to be on. Americans to be aware of that as a way of raising a huge amount of revenue, that you actually tax the entire wealth of the richest people in society at a very small percentage that would generate huge amounts for things that we need as a society. That's very brilliant. And then you have a lot of ideas about campaign finance reform, for example, and the Green New Deal, fabulous way of reframing both the environmental sustainability question and the question of justice in society and job creation, all the rest of it. That's not a new idea, but it's now newly on the agenda. So I'm excited about the discourse for the first time in my life. I think the actual content of what's being just said by the people running in the Democratic Party is actually very promising, and owes a lot to Bernie's initiative. I think it's not that Bernie did this; it's that Bernie showed brilliantly that there's this vast hunger in the society and in the Democratic base in particular for a structural social change, not just for tinkering around the edges. And it has to be the case that young people facing the dire warnings about the climate change would see the absolute necessity of moving quickly in these more radical ways. That I don't know that we'll achieve those. We don't even know what the election results are going to be, let alone whether the structural changes are possible. I think people on the left need to, while they get excited with all these ideas, they need to pay attention to what Marxism teaches us about social change. If you propose a health insurance program that will wipe out the capacity of private corporations to make profits out of healthcare, you are in for a class struggle over that. You can't just say, well, we need the brave members of Congress to vote for that, and then we'll be able to do it. That is not Marxist, and that's not a criticism. It's not dealing with the structural realities of power to simply think that we need people to be braver in their voting pattern or more coherent in their advocacy of these things. It's a tremendous, and it isn't simply the campaign contributions of the pharmaceutical industry or other corporations that are going to determine the outcome. That's not even the most important factor. And we don't even know yet what resources of power corporate interests that feel deeply threatened by structural change, what resources they have for manipulating and blocking change. It's not just campaign contributions. It's simply refusing to invest. It's the economic power that's there among the wealthy, the super rich, and the corporations is itself, whether it's used in campaign contributions or not, is itself a way of affecting the life chances of people directly by saying, well, we can't invest because these regulations won't let us have profits, and therefore investment stops, and therefore jobs are lost, and therefore public support for change dries up. That's not an unusual pattern, but it's something that's out there as a reality. So we have to be strategic. Bernie's pretty strategic. And I think when he demands Medicare for all and a single payer system as the standard, that's strategically right, because it then means that when the bills are passed, the compromise will be a public option. It will be Medicare for options for people. It won't be Medicare for all, but it will be a more social medicine than we have now. That's what I'm expecting. See what I'm saying? That if you give away the store in your initial demand and compromise before the battle, then you've lost the battle. But if you can coherently demand and create a standard of achievement and goal that you're serious about, then compromise works as a positive thing in terms of the dynamic of society. If we demand free tuition for every student in public higher education, that leads to initial efforts to get free tuition for community colleges. But the standard remains there as a vision and a goal to be struggled over. If we and I think in every area of great social need, I think where compromise is going to be less possible is with respect to climate change. And yet we haven't figured out on a national level how to move things in a direction that actually might save the planet. So that's people say I'm an optimist. I'm not. I am hopeful because I see these forces, these movements for change as very promising, these ideas as very promising, but I am not optimistic about being able to overcome the criminal power of corporate and ruling upper class wealthy sectors to resist the needed changes out of their own greed and actual criminality. The billionaire class has a higher crime rate than we find in deprived urban communities, I think. So that's my speech.
It's a helpful one. And I'll just add that the Bernie Sanders moment is a great way that pulls together the themes from the book, these personal biographies, and this political moment. Another thing that makes this book so perfect for the moment. We've taken a lot of your time, Dick. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. And I recommend the book, Making History, Making Blintzes, to all of our listeners. So thanks again.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be able to give these little speeches. And I'm glad to learn about this podcast site, and hope to use it. But thanks, Patrick, for the initiative. Thank you very much.